Well, as previously announced, I will go over the prologue of the Anurag Saga here, and I will try to include the notes that have already been written when required. Many of the notes that I've written assume a very little knowledge of Sant Mat, and those notes, some of them, such as the one that explains the concept of Satguru, Karma, etc., I will not read every single one of those. Some I will read anyway, such as the ones of Kal, Satpurush, etc., because in some cases we may be a little unclear. I'll try to explain a little bit about the way the poem is made as we go along. As I said week before last, with the Master's approval, I've divided it into five basic parts, of which the first one is the prologue, which sets up the basic ground on which the poem is laid. And the poem is a dialogue, is written in the form of a dialogue between Kabir and his disciple Dharamdas, who Dharamdas became a master and served as a Satguru after the passing of Kabir. And a line of gurus was founded by him, which, as far as I know, is not in continuation at the present day, although I don't know for sure. Dharamdas was one of the richest men in India, and the story is well known. Kabir is not given in the Anurag Saga, although it's made very clear that the catching of Dharamdas was a very important part of Kabir's incarnation. But the story is told of how Kabir went into Dharamdas's house, where Dharamdas and his wife were sitting. Dharamdas had searched for a guru for many years and had never found one. He was a very wealthy man. He and his wife were sitting in front of the fire, and Kabir walked into their house unannounced, had never met them before, and accused them of violating the doctrine of ahimsa, non-violence. Dharamdas defended himself very vigorously and said that they had been scrupulously careful all their lives to never kill anything, and they had been strict vegetarians. And Kabir went over and poked the log apart that was burning in the fireplace, and it turned out that it was full of ants, which were burning up. And he walked out the door and disappeared. And it is said that Dharamdas was so impressed by that incident that he searched for Kabir for many years and spent all his money in doing so. And when he had spent it all and was reduced to poverty, he and his wife found Kabir and were initiated by him. So he was a very special disciple, a Gurumukh disciple, even though many times in this poem he appears as not a very exemplary disciple, because he asks a great many intellectual questions. And anyone who reads it, this is a little bit amusing, because many of us have had the experience of being put down for asking exactly the kind of questions which Dharamdas asks in this poem. And all I could say is there's a time and a place for everything. Dharamdas also gets put down pretty heavily at one point in the course of the poem when he pushes things too far. A very interesting part of the poem is it is not just a dialogue. The relation between Kabir and Dharamdas and the interaction between them is a part, that also is a part of the action of the poem. And at a point about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through, what's happening is their interaction is the subject matter, not the story that Kabir is telling Dharamdas. They become the principal actors, and what's taking place is in the present between the two of them. So the poem is set up in a very standard way for Indian poetry. It's very, very different from the songs of Kabir or other masters that we know. Those are lyric poetry, and this is an epic poem, and the difference, those of you who know the poetry of William Blake know that his lyric poems are very different from his epic poems, and we have a very similar situation here. But as with Blake and as with all poets who have written both lyric and epic poems and who are also mystics, the lyrics express in song form what the epic spells out in more detail. This poem also has many sections which are marked hymn and couplet in our translation. Those are sections that are marked that way in the original, and in the book which we used as the manuscript, as the basis for the translation, a published book in Bombay, which had been put together by Swami Yogalananda from 16 different editions that he found and collated together, so that it was something of a critical edition. In that book, the sections marked hymn and couplet are printed in larger type. They are small lyrics which are embedded in the body of the poem, very much the way that arias or songs are embedded in an opera, although the main melodic recitatives will carry the bulk of it. It will burst into song from time to time. Of course, in the English, it's hard to tell the difference between the hymns and the couplets and the rest of it, but we felt that it was important to carry that through, and I will read, when I reach the part that says hymn and couplet, I will read that, so that you can see how often they occur. Okay, it begins with an invocation, and I will read the invocation, although I'm not sure if we can get this more translated. It's basically a calling on all of the people who are mentioned in the course of the poem, including the four incarnations of Kabir by name, and Dharam Das, Chudumani, Sudarshan, all of whom are masters who figure in the poem at one time or another, plus names of various attributes of God. And this is a standard way for poets to begin. So the invocation just reads in Hindi words, only the last two are translated. Satya Sukrit Adi Adli Ajar Achint Purush Maninder Karunamai Kabir Surati Yog Santiyan Dani Dharam Das Chudumani Nam Sudarshan Nam, that means in the name of Chudumani, in the name of Sudarshan, Kulpati Nam Pramod Guru Balapir Keval Nam Amol Nam Surat Sunchi Nam, Hak Nam, Pak Nam, Pragat Nam, Dhiraj Nam, Ugara Nam, Grace of God, the grace of the lineage of 42 incarnations. And that particular lineage of 42 figures very prominently toward the end of the poem. It refers to the particular line of masters which will proceed from Kabir through Dharam Das, and which incidentally has nothing to do with the line of masters that we follow, which proceeded from Kabir through Nanak. And it's a very curious fact that that particular line of masters, the masters coming down from Guru Nanak and his successors, do not figure in this poem at all. There is no mention of them, nor are they, do they play any part in the poem. And yet, as we know, that line of masters holds this poem in very high regard. The second thing, Mangla Charan, Hymn of God's Grace. This is again a standard way to open poem. First of all, I salute the Satguru, who showed me the inconceivable God, who, lighting the lamp of the Master's knowledge and opening the veil, made me have his darshan. With Master's grace, I have achieved him to achieve whom scholars work very hard. His form cannot be described. His soul is the nectar in which I have absorbed myself. Gurudev is perfect. And these are little subtitles that figure also, and they get less and less as the poem goes on. They were not written by Kabir. They are in modern Hindi, and they were added to make the poem a little more comprehensible to the average reader. Because the language of this poem is not modern Hindi. It is what is called Brij, which relates to modern Hindi about the way Chaucerian English relates to our English, so that for the average reader to read it without help is almost impossible. So these subheads are there to be helps, and in some cases they explain in English too. They are very helpful, and they have been left in, they have been translated and left in. The Master is an ocean of grace. He showers grace on the miserable ones. Rare are those who know his secret. He manifests himself in those who recognize him. Who deserves it? Him. Only the connoisseur who will test the Shabda. And this phrase, test the Shabda, is used a lot in the poem. And I questioned it, because it seemed like not exactly the way we ought to relate to the Shabda. But that's what the language says. There's no other way to translate it. And it means, who will take what I say so seriously that he will put it into practice and see for himself. That's the sense of it. Only the connoisseur who will test the Shabda and listen to the teachings with full attention, and within whom these teachings will dwell, only he will understand this. He within whom the sun of knowledge will manifest and remove the darkness of attachment, only he will understand this. I am telling you this Anurag Sagar, this ocean of love, only rare saints will understand. And the title, by the way, should be pronounced Anurag Sagar. There's nothing about cigars or rags in it. And we should try, because it sounds very odd to Indians if it's pronounced in that way. The ocean of love is in contrast to the Bhavsagar, or the ocean of this world, which is often also referred to very often throughout the poem. It refers to the original creation of Satpurush, the Anurag Sagar, as opposed to the later creation of Kal, which is the Bhavsagar. Without love, one cannot achieve it. Couplet. Any learned saint who thinks over my words and has love in his heart will achieve nirvana. The signs of a lover. Dharam Das said, O Satguru, folding my hands, I beg you, please clear up this doubt of mine. How do I recognize the one within whom love manifests? What does a lover look like? Without love, the jiva cannot be liberated. Oh, my God, tell me about that love and give examples to explain it to me. Examples of a lover's qualities. The Satguru said, O Dharam Das, I will explain to you the qualities of the lover. Listen attentively so that you may recognize him. Throughout this poem, as in all the writings of the masters, of course, they are using frameworks and structural mechanisms and images also, which are very much a part of Indian literature as a whole. If you study the Mahabharata, which was written thousands of years before this, you will find the same basic structure, the dialogue structure between people and the way of speaking to each other, the way the disciple speaks to the master, the way the master speaks to the disciple, is a stylistic and structural motif that's very common in Indian literature. And these examples, of course, we are familiar with them for the most part. They have been used by many masters, and Kabir has used them in many places, not just in this place. Example of the deer. Intoxicated by the music, the deer runs and comes to the hunter. He doesn't have any fear, not even when he sacrifices his head. Hearing the music, he sacrifices his life. A lover should do the same. Example of the moth. A lover should be like a moth when it goes near light. Both of these examples are used in other places, I think. I may be wrong, but I think later on in the same poem are used also as negative examples. In other words, they can take both meanings. Here there's certainly a positive example. The lover should not think of what he's doing any more than the deer or the moth does. But in other places they are used as examples of idiocy, that we are totally out of control, so we just go wherever we want and get destroyed. Many things are like that. They can work both ways. Example of Sati. O Dharam Das, listen to more examples and manifest the Satguru's Shabda. Be like the woman who burns herself with her dead husband and while burning doesn't move her body. One who leaves her house, wealth, and friends, and in the pain of separation goes alone. She doesn't stop even when people bring her son before her and try to catch her in attachment. When people say, your son is weak and will die, and without you your home will be lonely. When people say, you have plenty of wealth, come back home. She is in the pain of separation from her husband and nothing attracts her. Him. People try to persuade her in many ways, but the determined woman doesn't listen. She says, my condition is such that I have nothing to do with wealth and property. In this world, one lives for a few days, and in the end, none is our companion. So, dear friends, understanding this, I have caught hold of my husband's hand. Couplet. Thus, with determination, she climbs the funeral pyre, and taking her husband in her lap, she becomes Sati, repeating the name of the Lord. And I've written a long note on this. Now, these notes are, of course, written by me. They carry with them, you know, any disadvantage that that might entail. They are written, however, at the master's orders. Some of them have already been read to him. All of them will be, and nothing will be published that he doesn't approve. So far, he has been very supportive. As long as you understand that they are written at my level, I think that it will be helpful. It is a curious paradox that Kabir, who uses sati as an image of absolute faithfulness and love here and elsewhere in his poetry, should have resolutely opposed it in practice. But it is the difference between the ideal and the reality. These lines explicitly portray a wife so identified with her husband that she has no ability to live on a plane where he is not, and so follows him in death, voluntarily, joyfully, and despite the conventional wisdom of her friends and relations, exactly as the true devotee feels about God. But the ugly reality of the custom as it became a Hindu law was something else. A terrified widow, forced by public opinion to burn herself in going along with it because she literally had no future. When her husband died, she lost her identity and became a non-person. Far from urging her to live, her neighbors and friends forced her to die, and if she somehow evaded her fate, she became an untouchable. All masters, including Kabir, opposed this vicious custom, but they also continued to use the ideal as a poetic image of the love of the true devotee for God. Qualities of the real lover. O Dharamdas, understanding the reality, I am telling you about love. Those who meditate on Nam in such a way that they forget their family, who do not have the attachment of son and wife, and who understand this life as a dream, are real lovers. And of course, phrases like the attachment of son and wife have to be understood in the context of Indian society, when it was considered a man was considered less than a man if he was not married and did not have at least one son. He must marry and have a son in order to carry on his family name. And this was a very tremendously important thing for thousands of years in Indian culture. Brother, in this world life is very short, and the world doesn't help at its end. In this world, woman is loved the most. Not even parents are loved so much. But the woman for whom one lays down his life doesn't help at the time of death. She weeps for her own self and at once goes to her parents' home. Son, kinsfolk, and wealth are dreams, so my advice to you is to achieve Sat Nam. Nothing goes with us in the end, not even the body which we love so well. And of course, I have another note. Note the difference between the attitude of the woman pictured here and that of the sati described above. This is a far more realistic description, obviously, of a society where sati was not forced. Who can release us from Kal? Brother, I don't see anyone who can release us at the end time, except one whom I will describe, loving whom your purpose will be served. The Satguru is the only one who can get us released. Believe this as true. What does the Satguru do? Defeating Kal, he takes the soul to the motionless plane, where Satpurush is. Reaching there, one finds infinite happiness and is freed from coming back to this world. Who can reach the motionless plane? Him. One who will climb the path of truth believing my words, like the warrior who marches ahead in battle and doesn't worry about what is behind. So become like the warrior and the sati, and take the knowledge of the path from the saint. Take refuge in the Satguru, and developing mritak, rid yourself of Kal's pain. Rare are those who deserve it. Couplet. Kabir says this after reflection. Only the brave one who does this can achieve the beloved. All right, I want to read a couple of notes about Satpurush and Kal, although this will be explained much more fully later in the poem also. Satpurush, the true being. Actually, the true person is probably an actual. Purush means person, and Sat means true or existent. And sometimes later in the poem he's called Adi Purush, which means the original person. The first full expression of the absolute God, called also the Supreme Father or the Positive Power, he is the Lord of Sach Khand, and is the highest form of God that can be called personal, also called Sat Nam. And Kal means literally time or darkness. The meaning of the word is time, I think, which dominates the use of his name by the modern masters and in Anurag Sagar. The name of the negative power, or that aspect of the one God that flows downward and is responsible for the creation and maintenance of the causal, astral, and physical planes. A very large part of Anurag Sagar is concerned with Kal, who, as explained below, is one of the 16 sons of the Satpurush, or positive power, and who fell from grace and favor through demanding the sovereignty of the three worlds. He is the father of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and sends his incarnations into the world from time to time, both to maintain justice and redress wrongs, and also to mislead seeking souls and prevent them from leaving the confines of the three worlds. Kal is not necessarily evil. A careful reading of Anurag Sagar will show that, given the fact of the lower creation, his work is necessary. Yet neither is he good. He is most certainly not God, yet he demands to be worshipped as though he were. Because he does his best to keep individual souls from leaving the lower creation, he is the ancient foe of the saints, or incarnations of Satpurush, whose work is precisely to help souls leave the lower creation. In the Jewish Christian tradition, he is in some ways analogous to Satan, in others to the priestly conception of Yahweh in the Old Testament, not, however, to the prophetic use of that name, which refers to a God of mercy and love. The Gnostics called him the Demiurge and understood him very well. Perhaps the closest analog in Western literature is William Blake's Urizen, who, like Kal, functions as the great lawgiver, compare Kal's other name, Dharamrai, using his laws to trap humanity and who demands to be worshipped as God. Also called Narinjan, in fact, Kal's full name is Kal Narinjan, which means beyond illusion. He is beyond illusion because he has created it. Although Kal is often referred to in Anurag Sagar as unjust, that is from the perspective of Satpurush and Kabir. Within the context of the worlds that he has made, he is absolutely fair and just, demanding an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and getting it. Since within the framework of the rule of law and the condition of the lower worlds, we cannot avoid sin, it is true that we get exactly what we deserve according to the law of karma. But since the ultimate reality of the human condition is that we are children of Satpurush, drops of his essence, Kal, seen from that perspective, prevents us from realizing our full personhood and thus is monstrously unjust. Our mind is related to Kal in the same way as our soul is related to Satpurush. That may be expanded much further and probably will be part of the introduction rather than a note at that place. Who is a mritak? Is the next section, and this mritak means literally dead while alive. It's one of the words that was impossible to translate in any real good way, even though it's unfamiliar, so it was left in. It's an old Indian concept, and when the masters say die while living, they are referring to this. Dharam Das said, O my God, tell me the qualities of mritak, so that the fire which is burning in my mind may be extinguished. O cloud of nectar, explain to me, how can this life die? Examples of mritak. Kabir said, Dharam Das, this is a complicated thing. Only a few can learn this from a perfect master. Example of bringi. Those who serve the saints as mritak, ultimately, grasping shabda, achieve the path to God. Just as the insect who, coming in contact with bringi, develops its body. Bringi attacks the insect with its sound, and one who catches that sound is taken by the bringi to his home, where he turns it into his own form. The insect who catches the sound of bringi itself becomes bringi. Rare are the insects who catch the sound of bringi at the first attempt. Some catch it at a second attempt, some at a third, and sacrificing their body and mind, they become the form of bringi. The insect who doesn't catch the sound of bringi remains as an ordinary insect forever. O Dharam Das, the disciple should receive the knowledge from the master as the insect receives the sound from bringi. And then I have a note. This curious phenomenon, which is apparently natural history and not mythology, many of the references in both this poem and on many of the writings of the masters to biological phenomena are mythological, but I don't think this one is. It is commented on by Sant Kripal Singh Ji as follows. Quote, Bringi, an insect, after almost killing a keet, another insect, revives the latter to life by bestowing its powerful attention to it. The keet, when charmed back to life, is no longer a keet, but becomes a Bringi being saturated with the life impulse of the latter. In just the same way, Kabir says that one who does Simran and gets firmly engrafted therein will have new birth and new life, quite distinct from the old sensual life he has been living hitherto. In the Way of the Saints, pages 121 to 22. That's from the Simran, the sweet remembrance. Oh God! How does one achieve the quality of Bringi? One who is determined to accept the teachings, I make him my own form, leaves the words of the masters, only he becomes the Bringi. When the crow merges itself into Shabda and leaves all her desires, she becomes a Hansa. And of course here, with the opposite, the word Hansa is often translated swan. As pictured in Indian art, it does look like a swan, but it's not a real swan, because for one thing, it eats pearls, and for another, it has the ability to separate milk from water by churning it with its beak. And it's a mythological development of the idea of a swan, and the word Hansa also now means soul. For example, in the term Paramhansa, means literally great swan, but it has the same meaning as Mahatma, or great soul. What is a Hansa? Couplet. He who leaves the path of the crow and dwells on the true Shabda within, eating pearls, who gives his life to Satpurush by following the path shown by the masters, is a Hansa. More examples of Mritik. Hear, O saints, the nature of Mritik. Rare are those who practice the path of God. Hear more attributes of Mritik. Mritik serves the Satguru. Mritik manifests love within him, and receiving that love, the jiva gets liberation. Of course, the word jiva, I think everyone knows, but possibly someone doesn't. It means really the soul when bound and forgetful. The liberated, fully conscious soul is called Atman, but the two terms are often used interchangeably. Ordinarily, when saints refer to jivas, they mean individual souls in the bound and forgetful state. But not always. Once in a while, it's used as a synonym for Atman. Example of the earth. The earth hurts no one. You be like that. Some put sandalwood on her, some throw dirt on her. Still she hates no one. Mritik also hates no one. He is very happy, even when opposed. Example of the sugar cane. Listen to more attributes of Mritik and step on the path shown by the master only after testing it and understanding it. When the farmer makes jaggery out of sugar, he cuts the sugar cane into pieces. Then it is crushed in the press and the juice is heated in a cauldron. After boiling the juice, jaggery is made, and boiling the jaggery, raw sugar is obtained. Heating the raw sugar, refined sugar is obtained. When sugar again burns herself, rock candy is obtained. Kabir says, from rock candy, sugar candy, which is liked by everyone, is made. In the same way, if the disciple bears all his sufferings with Master's grace, he can easily cross the ocean of life. Who can develop the qualities of Mritik? Him. Dharamdas, to develop the qualities of a Mritik is hard. Only a brave soul can do it. The coward cannot bear to hear it. He runs away and feels as if his body and mind are burning. Only those disciples who are looked after by the master can board the boat of master's knowledge. And this is true, that one who gets that knowledge definitely goes to his eternal home. Only Mritik is a sadhu. Couplet. Only he who becomes Mritik is a sadhu, and only he realizes the Satguru. He removes all illusions, and even the gods depend on him. And there, I think we will end for today. We will continue our reading from the Anurag Sagar, which we began last week. For the benefit of anyone who wasn't here, I will repeat some of the things I said, that the Anurag Sagar, translated as the Ocean of Love, is an epic poem of Kabir, that it differs from the lyric poems or the bhajans of Kabir in the same way as the epic poems and lyric poems of any other poet differ from each other, although it does contain embedded in it a number of lyrics or bhajans which are headed as hymn and couplet in the English translation. The poem is in the form of a dialogue between Kabir and Dharamdas, who became a Gurumukh disciple of Kabir and eventually became a master after Kabir left the body. There is another aspect to the relation of Kabir and Dharamdas that I didn't mention last week, which becomes important later in the poem. And that is that even though Kabir and Dharamdas are historical people, and Kabir wrote this poem, actually, he probably did not write it, per se, because all the evidence points to the fact that he was illiterate, but he gave it out. Dharamdas presumably wrote it down. Even though these are historical people, in a very real sense, Kabir is figuring as the universal master, that is, as all masters, and Dharamdas as all people, or every man, all disciples. If we understand this, we understand, first of all, why he asks so many dumb questions, because they are questions that any of us might ask. And also, the name Dharamdas means literally the slave of law. And one of the names of Kal, or the negative power, and a name that's used a lot in the course of this poem, is Dharamrai, or the king of law. So we see that Dharamdas is all of us, stands for all of us, enslaved by Kal, rescued by the master, and that the poem is the dialogue between the master and the disciple, understood in a universal way. All right, we left after the concept of mrityak, or the dying while living, was described. We concluded with the couplet, only he who becomes mrityak, that is, he who learns to die while alive, is a sadhu, and only he realizes the Satguru. He removes all illusions, and even the gods depend on him. Sadhu, of course, is used in this poem and in the writings of the masters generally in a very specific sense. It means one who has reached Daswandwar, or the third plane, a very high soul. In popular usage, a wandering monk, usually wearing saffron or yellow robes. That is not its meaning in Anurag Sagar or in other writings of the masters. These notes that I'm reading from, as I explained last week, were written by me on the orders of the master, and they are meant only to clarify and to explain, and they need not be taken any more authoritatively than anyone wants to take them, but still, they are the best that can be done. Another point is that sadhu is often used in the writings of the masters as a synonym for sant. Sant, strictly speaking, is someone who has reached the fifth plane, and sadhu, one who has reached the third plane. But it is very often true that the sants refer to themselves or to other sants as sadhus, and of course, it follows that all sants are sadhus because they have all reached the third plane. Not all sadhus are sants, but all sants are sadhus, so that the term is synonymous to that extent. Who is a sadhu? O Dharamdas, path of the sadhu is very difficult. He who lives as mrityak is a perfect sadhu. He who has controlled the five organs of senses and drinks the nectar of Naam day and night is a sadhu. Controlling the organ of seeing. First of all, control the eyes, and meditate on the Naam received from the Master. Seeing the beautiful form of God is the only worship for these eyes. He should not desire any other. One who understands beautiful and ugly as the same, and doesn't look at the body, enjoys happiness forever. Controlling the organ of hearing. His ears should be fond of hearing good words, and should not like to hear bad words. But he who bears both, good and bad words, likes the knowledge of the Master to remain in his heart. And good and bad, the paradox here is that good and bad, as we normally understand them, are dualistic and have meaning only in reference to Kal's worlds. But in Sant Mat, good means that which leads us toward God, and bad, that which keeps us away from God. In this couplet, the first line refers to good and bad in the second esoteric sense, the second line to their outer dualistic sense. Controlling the organ of smell. The nose is controlled by pleasant smells, but the clever saints keep it in their control. Controlling the organ of taste. The tongue wants pleasant tastes, sour, sweet, and delicious tastes, but the mritik does not know any difference between tasty and tasteless things. He does not get excited even if he has brought the five nectars, panchamrit. He does not refuse food without salt and lovingly accepts whatever is served him. Controlling the male genital organ. This organ is wicked and very sinful. I have a note here. Kabir's wording here is characteristically blunt and does not take into consideration 20th century capabilities. But what does the word sinful mean when the masters use it? According to Kripal Singh, the masters give a very simple definition of sin as forgetting of origin or Godhead. Once this is understood, the passage is unarguable. Lust is conquered by only a few ones. A lustful woman is the mine of Kal. Leave her company and become the knower of the Guru. Another note. That is, as the context implies, woman when seen as sex object by man under the control of his genital organ. She is a mine of Kal because of what the uncontrolled desire of the male is projecting onto her. If she does have lust of her own, she is no worse than the male, as the preceding verse makes clear. Passages like these should be read in context and not understood to imply any anti-woman attitude, either in Anurag Sagar or in the Santmat teachings as a whole. Many passages in the poem and in other writings of the masters view woman as child of God in person. In fact, this is the basis of the idea of chastity, that a woman's existence as a person is marred when she is seen as a sex object and related to in that way. There have been a number of woman saints, and the masters have been very insistent that in the eyes of God, sex makes no more difference than race, religion, social status, or wealth. Controlling lust. Whenever the wave of lust comes, one should wake himself up. He should put his attention into Shabda, and, keeping quiet, should drink the nectar of Nam. When he merges into the elementless, lust will be finished. The god of lust is a robber. Him. Lust is a mighty, dangerous, and pain-giving negative power, which made the gods, munis, yakshas, gandharvas, indulge in sex. All of them were plundered. Only a few who remained determined with the quality of their knowledge were saved. Those who have the light of the Satguru's knowledge and are with him have the secret of the path. Of course, the gods, munis, yakshas, and gandharvas are all people referred to in Indian mythology who were very mighty but also very vulnerable. The Mahabharata especially is full of stories of this sort, which are probably the ones referred to here among others. The ways of escaping from lust, the robber. Couplet. Enlighten your inner self with the lamp of knowledge. Meditate on the Satguru Shabda, and the thief of darkness will run away. Example of the Anul bird. And there's a note. Mythological bird. All Indian scriptures are full of references to creatures like these, and Anurag Sagar is no exception. These examples and stories are told to illustrate a human psychological point and should be understood as parables, not lectures in biology. Sant Kripal Singh has written that the master, quote, makes frequent use of such concepts and doctrines from ancient Hindu lore, but he refers to them not in a spirit of scientific truth, but often as a divine poet who employs illusion and mythology to drive his point home. Japji, page 94. With the grace of the master, the jiva is called sadhu, and becoming the anul bird goes back to his eternal home. Dharamdas, understand these words. I am telling you about the anul bird, who lives in the sky and is supported by the air day and night. She performs the sexual act through the eyes, and in that way becomes pregnant. She lays her eggs in the sky where there is no support. The egg is nourished while falling. In the sky it is hatched, and the young bird takes birth. It is on the way that it opens its eyes, and on the way that it gets its wings. When it finally reaches the earth, it realizes that this is not its home. Realizing that, it flies back to where its parents live. The Unul bird doesn't come down to bring the baby back. It itself goes home, treading the path. Many birds live in this world, but very few of them are Unul birds. Birds like that are rare, and rare are the jivas who merge themselves in Nam. If the jiva can practice this path, he can go back to Satlok, triumphing over Kal. The note on Nam may be useful to some, and I will read it. Actually, it came at a slightly earlier point. It's a term that's used, of course, constantly in the writings of the masters, and most initiates are very familiar with it, but still. Literally means name, here used as synonym for shabda, or sound current, the primordial creative power of God, which is also the essence of each individual. In this sense, it is the exact equivalent of the Greek term logos, or English word, as used in the New Testament, particularly in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, where the concept is described in great detail. Nam can also mean name in the usual sense, just as logos can mean word in the usual sense. The saints use the terms dunatmak and varanatmak to distinguish between the two, the former term referring to the sound current or creative force, the latter to names that can be spoken in human speech. The opening passage of Tao Te Ching makes the same distinction. When does a sadhu become like an Unul bird? Him. When he goes only in the refuge of the Satguru and keeps only one desire, of Nam, when he keeps himself in the service of the Satguru day and night and has no desire for wealth and property, when he forgets son, wife, and all the enjoyments and keeps himself attached to Satguru's feet, then he becomes like an Unul bird. What does the master give to such a sadhu? With the grace of the Satguru, he gets relief from the unbearable pain and achieves Satlok. And Satlok, of course, which also figures very much in the Anurag Sagar, is the region of truth, the fifth inner plane, first completely spiritual plane, and the seat of Satpurush, that is the true God, or the positive power. This is the stage to which perfect masters or sants take their disciples. Satpurush himself takes them further into the absolute. Guru Nanak referred to this plane as Sach Khand, the Sufi masters as Mukami Hak. It is the court of the saints. How does one get to the motionless plane? It is Avichal Dham in the original. There's another name for Satlok. Couplet. By remaining in the master's remembrance, in thought, word, and deed, and by obeying the orders of the master. Master gives one who does this the gift of liberation, and merges him in Nam. The greatness of merging in Nam. As long as the jiva doesn't merge himself in Nam, he wanders in this world. When he contemplates on the formless and merges into Nam, all his doubts go away. If he merges into Nam even for a moment, its greatness cannot be described. Everybody talks about Nam, but rare ones achieve the formless Nam, that is the dunatmak Nam. The first reference in the line is to Varanatmak Nam. That is, everyone talks about Nam, Varanatmak, but rare ones achieve the formless Nam, the Dunatmak. Even if one lives in Kashi for ages, without the essential Shabda, he will go to hell. Kashi is also called Benares, the holiest of all Hindu cities and the lifelong home of Kabir. It was widely believed that anyone who died in Kashi would be liberated. Consequently, devout Hindus from all over India tried to reach Kashi during their last illness. Many stories that the masters tell refer to this belief on the part of Hindus. It is said that Kabir, to expose the hollowness of such beliefs, deliberately left Kashi just before he died and went to Maghar, about which it was widely believed that anyone who died there went to hell. terminology of the Masters, hell can refer either to a particularly difficult incarnation on Earth, to the cycle of births and deaths in general, or to certain stages of the astral plane where particularly heavy karma is worked out. In no case is it eternal or everlasting, and when the karma is worked through, the individual is free to try again. See Kripal Singh, The Wheel of Life, pages 42 to 44. Nemkar, Badri Dham, Gaya or Prayag, even if he bathes in these holy places and goes to all the 68 places of pilgrimage, yet without the essential Shabda, illusion cannot go away. What can I say further about that Nam, repeating which the fear of Yama goes away? And Yama, of course, is another name of Kal, which is used quite a lot in this poem. It means the death god, the god of death. And if you think about it, in the ancient scriptures, the Mahabharata and so forth, it's assumed, it's understood without a lot of explanation that the god of time, that is Kal, is also the god of death, that is Yama, because time is where death has its meaning. Outside of time, there is no death. What does one get who receives Nam? One who gets Sat Nam from the Satguru goes to Sat Lok, climbing on the rope of Nam. Dharam Rai bows his head to him whose soul merges into the elementless. What is the essential Shabda, Sar Shabda in the Hindi? The essential Shabda is a bodiless form. The essential Shabda is beautiful, wordless. The body has elements and nature. The essential Shabda is elementless and bodiless. In all four directions, Shabda is talked about. Only the essential Shabda can liberate the souls. The name of Satpurush itself is the essential Shabda, and the Simran of Satpurush is the essential Shabda's recognition. Simran, of course, means remembrance. In the writings of the Masters, reference to the remembrance of God refers to the remembrance of God through the repetition of his five basic names, as given in the form of a mantra by the Master at the time of initiation. This repetition is done without tongue, see next line, that is mentally, and is one of the three basic meditation practices of Shabda Yoga. It is also a means of keeping in a state of remembrance at all times, even when not sitting in meditation, and a protection against Kal. And the recognition, the Simran of Satpurush, the name of Satpurush itself is the essential Shabda, and the Simran of Satpurush is the essential Shabda's recognition. This is a very interesting line. The first half is an explicit declaration of the esoteric identification of the Nam, or name of God, with the Shabda. The second half says that the ability to recognize, that is, hear and be pulled by the sound current, is dependent on the completion of Simran. This refers to the way in which the spiritual practices of Shabda Yoga lead to one another. One who merges into it without doing the Simran by tongue, even Kal is afraid of him. The path of the essential Shabda is subtle, easy, and perfect, but only the brave can follow it. It is neither a word, nor a Simran, nor a Japa. It is a perfect thing, achieving which one can conquer Kal. Japa means, of course, repetition of a mantra, usually orally, which distinguishes it from Simran, although the two words are sometimes, as here, used as synonyms. This line means that the ultimate path of the sound current is above all Simran or Japa, because only those who have completed and gone beyond that practice can walk it. The support of the soul is in the head, and now I will tell you of the recognition of Shabda. One who gets connected with the unrepeated repetition, that is the Ajapa Jap, which means the sound current, gets to see the infinite petal lotus. When he reaches the astral door, he ultimately goes to Agam and Agochar by way of the true path. His inner self, where Adi Purush, and Adi Purush means the original person. It's another name for Sat Purush, which means the true person or that person which exists, and it refers to the true God. Where Adi Purush resides, gets enlightened. Recognizing him, the soul goes to him, and he takes the soul to its origin. The soul is of the same essence as Satpurush, and is also called Jiva Sohang. Sohang means I am you. Its use here as a name for the soul emphasizes the identity of the soul and God, referred to in the first part of the line. Its coupling with Jiva underlines the irony of the soul's bound and forgetful condition when seen in the light of its true nature. As we read last week, Jiva, strictly speaking, refers to the soul when bound and forgetful, although the name Jiva also means life in Hindi, and it refers to the soul when living in the three worlds, within the context of the three worlds. Dharamdas, you are a wise saint. Recognize that Shabda which gives liberation. The method of meditating on the essential Shabda or Naam, the way of practicing Master's path. Him. Repeat the unrepeated, and with the grace of the perfect Master, test it. Keeping the wing of mind at rest, see the Shabda. And climbing the mind, finish your karma. Reach the place where the sound is produced without tongue, and the rosary beads are moved without hands. Merging into the essential Shabda, go to the world of immortality. Couplet. The glory of the inconceivable is limitless. Millions of suns and moons cannot vie with one hair. The radiance of one soul is equal to the light of 16 suns. The jubilation of Dharamdas. O God, I sacrifice myself at your feet. Removing my pain, you have made me happy. Hearing your words, I am as happy as a blind man given eyes. Kabir said, Dharamdas, you are a pure soul, who, meeting with me, have removed your pain. Just as you have loved me, leaving your wealth, home, and sons, in the same way, the disciples who will do this and, with determination, will attach their mind to Master's feet, and will manifest love within themselves for Master's feet, sacrificing their body, mind, and wealth on the Satguru, they will be most dear to me, and no one can ever stop them. Of course, that does not mean leaving wealth, home, and sons literally. Physically, it means leaving them in the sense of becoming unattached from them, leaving them mentally. The disciples who won't sacrifice everything and keep fraud in their heart while showing love on their face, how can they go to Satlok? Without manifesting Master within, they cannot achieve me. Dharamdas' Confession of Gratefulness. All this you have done, my God. I was very dirty. Showering grace on me, you yourself came to me, and holding my hand, have saved me from Kaal. Right, that is the conclusion of the prologue, and next week we will begin the main body of the poem, which is in three parts, the first part of which is the story of creation. We will begin next week with Dharamdas's question on the creation and how it all happened, and Kabir's answers, which are as interesting for what they don't say as for what they do, as we will find out. This is the second main part in the first part of the main body of the poem Anurag Sagar, or the Ocean of Love, of Kabir. This part is divided into several subsections. This first part is called In the Beginning, and it begins with a question about the creation. Dharamdas said, Now, my Lord, tell me where the plane of immortality is. Describe all the planes to me, and make me, the thirsty one, drink the nectar. Where does the soul live, and where is the residence of Satpurush? What does the soul eat there, and where does this sound come from? How did Satpurush create the planes, and why did he desire to create them? Tell me about the creation of the three worlds. Describe everything to me and hide nothing from me. How was Kaal Narinjan born, and how were the 16 sons born? How were the four kinds of created beings spread, and how were the souls thrown in the hands of Kaal? How were Kurma and Sheshnag born, and how were Matsya and Vara incarnated? How were the three gods born, and how was the starry sphere created? How was this body created? O Lord, tell me the story of creation, so that all my doubts may go away and my mind may become content. him. O Satguru, graciously tell this servant of yours the story of creation. Throw light on me with the nectar of your words, so that the fear of Yama may be destroyed. Understanding me as your slave, tell me every single thing and describe it. O Satguru, I am convinced that what you tell me will be true. Couplet. Your words are true and very dear to me. Your grace is indescribable. It is my good fortune that you have given your darshan to me. One thing that is important to point out about this question, because it has a lot of bearing on Kabir's answer, and that is that the question is framed entirely within the context of Indian or Hindu mythology. And one of the points of the poem is to correct, I think it's fair to say, to correct the current understanding of some aspects of that mythology. But Kabir in no case casts doubt upon the basic presuppositions with which Dharamdas is asking. And it's important to recognize, I think, as Kabir explains more about how the creation happened and the different things that happen, that mythology is a way of making that which is ununderstandable understandable in the terms of the person who wants to know. It doesn't mean that every single loose end is tied up and everything is explained. In fact, some of the questions that Dharamdas asks are not really answered, at least not by our standards, explicitly within the poem itself. A lot of this will become clearer as we go along. For example, the 16 sons, the 4 kinds of created beings, Kurma, Sheshnag, Matsya, and Vara are all figures, and of course the 3 gods, who are Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, are all figures in Hindu mythology. And Dharamdas, remember we mentioned last week, the slave of law is every man. And in India, every man believed in this basic framework implicitly without questioning it. Kabir said, Dharamdas, I have found you the appropriate person, and therefore I will tell you the secrets. Listen to the words of the beginning of creation, which is the sign of dissolution. I find that one of the most powerful of all the lines of the poem. Listen to the words of the beginning of creation, which is the sign of dissolution. In other words, whatever is created necessarily carries the inevitability of its dissolution with it. What was in the beginning? Dharamdas, listen. When there was no earth, sky, or lower regions, when Kurma, Vara, and Sheshnag didn't exist, and Sadasvat, Parvant, and Ganesha were not born, not even the 30 other gods were created then, I will tell you about that time. Couplet. When there was no Brahma, Vishnu, or Mahesh, and the Shastras and Puranas were not yet created, all these things were in the Satpurush then, like the shadow that lives in the banyan tree. Hymn. O Dharamdas, listen to the story of creation, which no one knows. Since the creation came into being after these events, what proof could I give? The 4 Vedas do not know these stories of Satpurush, because then the Vedas also did not exist. So how could they describe the indescribable? Couplet. The Vedas do not know anything about creation then, or understand the formless. The world follows the path of Veda, but the Jnani, condemning them, shows the right path. Jnani is a word that figures a lot in the Anurag Sagar, and it means knower. It's the same, sometimes you've seen it spelled J-N-A-N-I, which is the Sanskrit spelling. And how that's pronounced, no one really knows. The Greek equivalent is Gnostic. Gyan means knowledge in the highest sense, the esoteric knowledge of the creation available to those who live on the level of the 5th plane, and therefore really know what the universe is all about. Jnani, as used in Anurag Sagar, is a very high title, equivalent to master or sant, and is often applied to Kabir. In fact, Kabir is habitually referred to throughout the poem in 3 ways, either as Kabir, as the Satguru, or as Jnani. The birth of creation, the creation of Satpurush. When Satpurush lived in latent form, he had not created the body and matter. As oil is hidden in the lotus, in the same way Satpurush used to live, hidden. Lotus leaves have a greasiness which can be felt but not seen. In his will, he created the souls, and looking at them, he felt very happy. As the context shows, the souls are created by Satpurush out of himself. What follows is the blow-by-blow account, you might say, of exactly how this was done, insofar as it can be put into words. From the first Shabda created by him, the worlds and ocean were created in which he dwelt. He made the throne of four worlds and sat on the lotus. Where Satpurush sat, desire was created there. In the will of Satpurush, 88,000 islands were created. In all the worlds, his desire exists. His desire is very fragrant. And it's important to know the four worlds, the first thing, in other words, that is created out of Satpurush himself, or actually out of the Absolute God, is the what is called the purely spiritual creation, what the masters call Satdesh, which is often divided into four parts. Satlok, or Satchkand, which is the full manifestation of the Absolute or Essence into existence. Alaklok and Agamlok, which are stages in the manifestation of the Absolute. And Anami or Radhaswami, which is the Absolute Unmanifested Essence. In this level, the names for the gods or the persons and the names of the worlds are exactly the same. And at this level, when it is said that Satpurush created the throne of four worlds and sat on the lotus, the differentiation between God and where he is not probably existent by our standards, so it's a matter of speaking. And the desire, of course, the desire is the will of God. And without it, there would have been no creation. As Master Kripal Singh often used to say, God was one, and he said, I wish to become many. And that is the beginning of the creation. Manifestation of 16 suns. Now, each sun represents an aspect of Satpurush, which had to manifest separately in order for creation to take place. Even on the highest spiritual level. Creation, esoterically speaking, means just this, God separating himself into so many parts which become the creation. Since the ultimate reality is the oneness of God, not his manyness, there is a very real sense in which creation on any level, even the highest, is unreal and illusory. Kripal Singh has written, creation as such does not exist per se. The actual and the real is ever the same and is not subject to change. There can be nothing apart from the absolute unity. It projects itself into varying forms, which are an expression of its power. The Crown of Life, page 124. Note that Kal, or time, is also one of the suns, time being a part of the whole that only causes difficulties when separated from the rest. Thus, the fall of Kal and the whole lower creation are implicit in this first creative act of Satpurush. When, in other words, the God separated himself for the first time into these 16, you might say, rays, all of them represent parts of himself that were merged into oneness. Just as the sun, the light of the sun is white, but when it passes through a rain cloud or rain, then it separates into colors, and the colors are there, the white is also there. One of the 16 rays, what is called time, which is the literal meaning of Kal, was not capable of existing by itself in harmony with the others, although when it was part of the original, of the wholeness that was Adi Purush, of the original person, then it was. And I don't think there's any other way to understand how, when God separated himself into parts, one of those parts should turn bad. It has to be that the act of separation itself, that one aspect of him could not exist that way without difficulties. From the second Shabda of Satpurush, the Kurma was created. This is a very important figure in Indian mythology, and we will hear more of him later. But he is the first son of Satpurush, in other words, with the desire of remaining attached to his feet. When Satpurush uttered the third Shabda, a son named Gyan, or knowledge, was born. When he came before Satpurush and bowed down to him, he ordered him to go into creation. When the fourth Shabda was made, the son named Vivek, or discrimination, was created. He was ordered to live in creation by Satpurush. With the fifth Shabda, a brilliant light came into existence. When Satpurush uttered the fifth Shabda, Kal Narinjan, which remember means literally time the illusion maker, was incarnated. He is created from the most glorious part of the body of Satpurush. That is why he troubles the soul. This is, of course, a very ancient tradition. Although Kal fell, his original beauty is not completely destroyed. It makes his claim to be God more credible and his temptations more effective. Souls are of the essence of Satpurush, and no one knows their beginning and end. When, with his mouth, Satpurush uttered the sixth Shabda, Sahaj was born, which means contentment. With the seventh Shabda, Santosh was created. Santosh means contentment. Sahaj means effortlessness or fearlessness. When Satpurush uttered the eighth Shabda, Surat, or attention, was settled in the beautiful world. With the ninth Shabda was created infinite happiness, and the tenth Shabda created forgiveness. The 11th Shabda created a son named Nishkam, or selflessness, and the 12th Shabda created a son named Jalarangi. The 13th Shabda created Achint, or worrylessness, and with the 14th was created love. With the 15th Shabda, Dindayal, or the mercy on the poor, or the helpless, was born, and the 16th Shabda created patience. With the 17th Shabda, Yoga and the saints were created. They all were born from the same origin. Shabda created all the suns. Shabda created all the worlds and oceans. In every world, the parts of his essence, the jivas, or the souls, were settled, and their food was nectar. The beauty of the jivas is endless, and always happiness exists there. The glory of the jivas is endless, and always happiness exists there. The glory of the jivas is inaccessible and indescribable. Who can describe their endless beauty? All the sons meditate on Satpurush, and eating nectar, enjoy happiness. In this way, 16 sons were born. Dharamdas, take this to heart. Hymn. The limitless beauty of the worlds created cannot be described. It is a wonderful creation. Its beauty is such that it is impossible to describe in words. All worlds get light from the light of Satlok. Even the sun and moon shine with the light of one hair of Satpurush. Couplet. The Satguru is an abode of happiness. Grief, attachment, and pain do not exist there. Having the darshan of Satpurush, the jivas are enjoying. 2. The fall of Kal. This is the second main section within the story of creation. The devotion of Narinjan and his acquisition of Mansarovar in the void. In this way, many days passed, and after that this happened. Dharam Rai played this way. Dharam Das listened to it. Their attention, the wording of that line draws attention to Dharam Rai, which is another name for Kal, as the king of law or the lord of judgment, and Dharam Das as the slave of law or judgment. This is the relation between one and the other. Standing on one foot, he did the devotion of Satpurush for 70 yugas and pleased him. He did a very difficult devotion. That is why Satpurush was pleased. Now this is not only is this a very difficult devotion, but this is a very difficult thing to understand. I think, anyway, it's always been one of the things that has been very difficult for me to grasp. Why on earth should God be pleased because someone stood on one foot for 70 yugas? 70 yugas, by the way, 4 yugas is approximately 4 million years. That's the length of one cycle of 4 yugas. So we are dealing with time on a scale ungraspable by the human intellect. I talked with Sanchi a lot about this passage, and I came up with this note, which he said was correct, but he also said more things, which I'll tell you after I read it. Why should Satpurush have been pleased with this devotion? Kabir never explains this, yet it is a pivotal point in the development of Anurag Sagar. Kal means time, and since the devotion described implies the suspension of all his activity for incalculable periods of time, it would appear that the practices done by Kal pleased Satpurush because of their implications when done by him, rather than because standing on one foot has any particular objective merit. By stopping himself dead for such long periods, he postponed his own fall, and thus allowed the jivas that much more time with their father before being sent into the lower worlds. If this is true, it certainly is a cosmic paradox. His devotion postponed his fall, but it also brought it about. But as we have seen, his fall was probably inevitable once he was separated from the One. Now, Sansi said this was not incorrect, that this was true, and that the note should be in here. But he also said that it cannot be fully understood even in these terms, that ultimately the will of Satpurush is the will of Satpurush, and it doesn't matter, really, why he was pleased. The point that matters is that he was pleased. And this brings us right back to the paradox of existence, I would say, and that the universe is paradoxical in nature, as modern physics and science on all levels is discovering, that there are things that are simply not explainable by any standard or frame of reference that we can hold on to. And I think that it follows that any system that attempts to explain the universe that is not paradoxical is not anywhere near the truth. So both are a part of it. Also later on, in a very significant line, Satpurush says that he is not controlled by good or bad deeds, but by devotion. I think that's an accurate rendering. It's not in our reading today. I think it's just something that hasn't been set up in type yet. And that, of course, is the foundation of the principle of grace. And we can say, thank God that he's not controlled by good and bad deeds, or who would have a chance? On the other hand, it also allows Kal to please him by being devoted. I think also that what is involved here is not just, you know, like a human being doing incredible austerities, although in previous ages the Hindu scriptures are full of descriptions of people who did such things, and the masters often refer to them, as we know, Sringi Rishi and Parasura and many others. Often they fell, too. But here we are dealing with a whole, the scale and the scope of what is being discussed is nothing that is human. There's nothing human about it. We are dealing with the ultimate spiritual region of Satdesh. Nothing else has been created yet. We are dealing with persons who are existing so much more. Even Kal now at this point is existing on a much far higher level than is anything known to us. So that there is an enormousness and a tremendousness about everything that they do, which is a part of it. When things like that are diminished, they become changed in kind as well as in size. The word of Satpurush came to him and asked, "Why have you done this devotion?" Bowing his head, Dharam Rai said, "Please give me some place where I can live." And I think that this has to mean that time, or in his other aspect, law, was not happy in the spiritual plane because of his essence. In other words, once he was separated out from the whole and existed separately, it was not possible for him to live happily in Satdesh along with the other, you might say, his brothers, the other sons. Then he was ordered by Satpurush, "O son, go to Mansarovar." Now, Mansarovar is in Daswandwar. It's also called Amritsar. It's the Lake of Nectar, which is located there. And Daswandwar is not part of Satdesh. It's one of the two intermediary planes between Satlok and the three worlds of Kal's creation. Now, the poem does not seem to explicitly describe the creation of these intermediate planes, although it may be implicit in what is already said. In any case, they exist, and they are not created by Kal. Mansarovar would be at the farthest reach of the universe as it exists at this point. Thus, Kal is exhibiting his strong desire to remove himself from the influence and control of Satpurush. His fall, in other words, has already begun. The Dharam Rai felt much happiness in his heart and went to Mansarovar. When he came there, again he was full of happiness. Again he remembered Satpurush and did his devotion for 70 yugas more. He did this devotion standing on one foot, and the gracious Satpurush felt pity for him. When Satpurush manifested his words, this is what came on his lips. O Sahaj, I forgot to read the head. Satpurush speaks to Sahaj, who, remember, is one of the other sons, I think the one created just before Kal. O Sahaj, go to Dharam Rai and ask him why he has remembered me this time. He has done a very hard practice, so I give him the place where he lives. And in parentheses it says, so in a moment he was given the ownership of the three worlds. The three worlds, of course, however, are not created yet. I did this looking at his seva. The dear one has received the three worlds and is happy. Now go and ask him. Whatever he says, come and tell me. Sahaj goes to Narinjan. Bowing his head, Sahaj started from there and went to Dharam Rai. Sahaj said, listen, my brother, Satpurush has accepted your devotion. Now what do you want? Tell me, Satpurush has sent this message to you. Narinjan said to Sahaj, O Sahaj, my elder brother, go and make this request to Satpurush. I don't like this small place. Please give me a big kingdom. In my heart I have felt such love for him. He should bless me with a big place. He should either give me the world of the gods or else a separate world. After listening to Dharam Rai, Sahaj went to Satpurush and conveyed Dharam Rai's request to him. After hearing the words of Sahaj, Satpurush said this, I am pleased with Dharam Rai. Take this to your heart. I have given him the three worlds. Now go and tell him to develop the void plane. O Sahaj, tell him to make his creation there. Couplet. O Sahaj, go there quickly and tell this to Dharam Rai. He has been given the void plane where he can create his own universe. And that is a good stopping place, as the next section is not completed in what I have here. We will learn in the next installment the difficulties, the annoyance that Kal felt when it becomes apparent that he doesn't know how to create the universe, and also the significance of Kurma, who was the first created son of Satpurush, and within whose body the latency of the lower universe is located. In other words, the second Shabda brought into being Kurma, who is in turn contains the latency of the three worlds. Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and everything that belongs within the three worlds is located in Kurma. And how Kal gets that from him will be the subject of our next reading.